All right, we're up to slide 13, and what looks like an old-fashioned lamp timer here. Most lamp timers nowadays are electronic. You just key in whatever on-off times you want, but there's still plenty of these kind available that are, you know what I'm talking about, where you put the little piece of plastic somewhere in, and that'll hit a lever and turn the device on or off. That's what it kind of reminds me of, but the circle here is a cell cycle, and these little red flaps, which are not actually structures in reality, are called checkpoints. A checkpoint is part of the control of the cell cycle. And checkpoints occur between, you know, they don't occur just randomly anywhere along the cell cycle. They occur between major subdivisions of the cell cycle. So this G1 checkpoint is between G1 and S, for instance. Those are important places because to go from G1 to S means to transition from what is more or less your normal lifetime as whatever kind of cell you are to preparations for ending your own life so you can split into two new cells. But these checkpoints are not structures. They're not little red gates. A checkpoint is really just a set of chemical conditions. So last time we ended with those experiments I showed you that gave pretty convincing evidence that there is a chemical basis for control of the cell cycle. It didn't at all say what the chemical basis is. It just says probably there's chemicals involved, chemical signals of some sort that allow cells to know, in a sense, whether or not they should proceed through checkpoints. Well, the checkpoints themselves are really just chemical conditions within a cell. And if those chemical conditions are not met, then the cell will remain in whatever subphase is before that checkpoint. We can see this in 14. So some cells make it through checkpoints because those chemical conditions come into play. They come into existence. And in a multicellular organism like yourself, that means in multicellular organisms like humans, there are many different kinds of cells, some of which go through checkpoints a lot easier than others and a lot sooner. For instance, you lose millions of skin cells per hour. Just wind blowing on you will take away cells from your epidermis. Now, your epidermis, the part of your skin that you can touch, is already dead cells. But they obviously weren't always dead. And if you're losing millions of dead cells, you better replace those with millions of living cells, which are deeper in the layer that you don't touch. In other words, you need to replace cells at the same rate that they're lost if you're not going to just deplete your skin and die from that. So skin cells and other, that's just one example. Skin cells don't have very long lifetimes compared to the lifetime of the overall individual. To replace so many cells, that means the living cells need to quickly go through their cell cycle so that one cell becomes two by dividing. Cell division provides the extra cells, in other words. And therefore, those skin cells pretty easily get through this G1 checkpoint, which makes them not last very long. On the other hand, a typical neuron, as an example, is one that might never get past the G1 checkpoint. A typical neuron will live, I mean, unless it just dies before you die, a typical neuron will just live as long as you are as a single cell. It doesn't undergo cell division. And that's a special situation that we call G0. It really is G1 still. We just rename it G0 because in that cell, it's never going to get the signal to proceed through the cell cycle. It just stays in permanent G1, which we then rename as G0. But the point is here that these checkpoints are what really are determining whether a cell proceeds through the cell cycle. Well, we're still learning a lot about how this works, but in slide 15 we can see just some basic information on how cell cycle control can be exerted. And on the top of 15 we see a graph, two traces here. The one that is sharp and spiky is a trace of cyclin concentration, so the concentration of a protein in the cells called cyclin. And the higher on the graph, the greater the concentration is. The other one is MPF activity. Well, what is MPF, you might be asking? It's an acronym that stands for mitogen promoting factor. And then that brings up the question of what is a mitogen? Well, the gen part means, like in Genesis, create or cause. A mitogen is something that causes mitosis. In other words, it induces cell division in eukaryotes. And MPF, that word factor, we see this in a lot of words and a lot of phrases in biology. Factors are usually proteins of some sort that do some specific function, but we call them factors. It's just one of many examples of a factor. But it's mitogen promoting factor, that's also a protein. What's being graphed here, though, is MPF activity, not the concentration. All right? Now, on the bottom graph, we can see that we can see how these things fit together. CDK, which is another abbreviation, still another protein, by the way. CDK here, this little shape with the light purple shape, is an example of a kinase. That's what the K stands for. CDK stands for cyclin-dependent kinase. But it's a kinase. It's one of many kinases. This is just a specific example of a kinase. Kinases is a general category that refers to, well, first of all, they're enzymes, obviously, right? Because they're named kinases. Kinases are enzymes that have the specific function of phosphorylating other proteins. And when I first talked about functional groups, which is when I first talked about phosphorylation, right, before we even got to the unit 3, I said that phosphorylation is a way that cells can switch things on or off. Well, the things that get switched on or off, activated or deactivated, are proteins of various sorts, including other enzymes. Kinases are enzymes that phosphorylate other things, which can be still other enzymes. And by phosphorylating them, they can turn them on or off. Depends on what the protein is as to whether phosphorylation is going to turn them on or turn them off. But that's what a kinase is in general. Cyclin-dependent kinase, which is CDK here, is an enzyme that does that job, but only when cyclin-dependent kinase is connected to a cyclin. So cyclin is a protein that, if it's there, will bind to cyclin-dependent kinase to turn on the kinase, which then can phosphorylate another protein and turn it on. And I don't want to get too bogged down into the details, but that's what's happening here. You have all kinds of proteins operating in succession, more or less. Well, when you look at the top graph, you can see that the cyclin concentration is low early on in the cell cycle, during G1S. G2, it starts to rise, and it spikes at the M phase. So more and more cyclin builds up in the cell, is what this sharp trace is telling you. Early on in the cell cycle, there isn't cyclin around. CDK is there the whole time. But CDK doesn't do anything unless cyclin binds to it, which is why it's called cyclin-dependent kinase. And that happens late in the cell cycle. By then, CDK is activated because cyclin binds to it, and the combination of CDK and cyclin, as you see here, is what we're calling MPF, the mitogen-promoting factor. In other words, MPF is activated CDK. And then it does its job of phosphorylating other proteins, and that detail isn't shown here, but what that has the effect of is spurring the cell into preparing to divide. That's how this results in control of the cell cycle. Look at cyclin, though, after it's done its job. After you get through this cell cycle, and now two new cells are starting their own cell cycle, the cyclin that was there gets degraded by the cell. It breaks it down so that it's no longer a signal. And therefore, that's why it's low again for each of those new cells starting their own cell cycle, and they'll have to build it up in their own cell cycle, which won't happen until it's appropriate for it to happen near the end when they're about to divide again. Any questions on all of that? All right. Let's go to 16 now. And in this petri dish is cells called fibroblasts. They're connective tissue cells from a human. And if you can grow these cells just in a dish rather than in an actual body of that they belong in, if you give them the proper nutrients, which is part of the medium. The medium is the blue stuff that they grow on. So if it's the correct medium, you're feeding them correctly, basically, they will remain alive. Okay, now, if you then plate these cells into these two different bottles, as you see here, one with a medium, the blue one, that does not have PDGF, and one that does, the results will be different. But what is PDGF? Well, this is another example of a protein that's called a factor. PDGF stands for platelet-derived growth factor. It's a growth factor, so it's a protein involved in cell division, which is part of growth, and they just happen to find it in platelets. That's why it's called platelet-derived growth factor. Okay. Well, this blue medium has all the stuff needed to feed the cells to keep them alive, but it doesn't have PDGF, which is the signal telling cells, in this case, to divide. And therefore, they will remain alive, those cells, however many you put on the medium, but they won't multiply. They won't proliferate because they're not given the signal to go into mitosis, and they'll just stay as single cells. But when you include all the food, the nutrients, plus PDGF, notice that they do proliferate. And proliferation is simply increase in numbers. It's multiplication of cells because of cell division. So this is just more evidence of chemical signal basis for control of the cell cycle. 17 is a related slide. Here you have cells growing in a dish. And when there's plenty of room, well, there's two concepts that are important here. Anchorage dependence and density-dependent inhibition, as you see. These types of cells have anchorage dependence, which means they will not divide into new cells unless they are anchored to a surface. For instance, in other words, if you have them just in a flask in solution, they're not anchored to anything, and they will remain alive if you feed them, but they won't get the signal to divide because they're not stuck to a surface. Because these are cells whose normal job it is to line a surface. They're epithelial cells. They need to be anchored to know they're in the right place, basically.
They're not flat against something, they're not going to work.
That's right. That alone is anchorage dependence. Density-dependent inhibition refers to the fact that if they are anchored to begin with, like they are at the top, they will divide, but they'll only divide until all of the available space is filled. And when they sense that they're all crowded next to each other, touching each other, in other words, there's no more space to fill, then they will be inhibited. They'll turn off the cell division so they don't overpopulate. That's density-dependent inhibition. The density is the population of cells. And so this is an important part of healing, right? When you injure an epithelium by cutting yourself, you destroy some cells, you leave a hole in the epithelium, basically, that needs to be filled. Well, the surviving cells will fill that hole by dividing, but only until the hole is filled, and then it'll shut back off so that they don't form more cells than are needed. And you can really see this is not just coincidence that this happened, because you can scoop some out again in this artificial scenario, and they'll turn back on to dividing, but only until they fill that new hole again, and then they'll stop again. Cancer is what happens when you lose control of the cell cycle. So there's all kinds of specific forms of cancer, but cancer in general is a genetic disorder, meaning disorder involving DNA, involving the genes. Being a genetic disorder does not mean that it's heritable. I mean, some genetic disorders are heritable, but cancer isn't. Cancer is a genetic disorder because something happens to the DNA. Something during the lifetime of the individual happens to the DNA, damages it in such a way that control of the cell cycle is lost. So the genes, in general, are indirect codes for how to build proteins, as we've said. Some of those genes are in control of, are coding indirectly for proteins that are specifically involved in control of the cell cycle. So if something happens to those genes, then the proteins they code for will either not be made at all or won't work, and therefore the cell loses control of the cell cycle. That's what cancer is. Cells, basically, that think, in a sense, that they're supposed to go through the checkpoints and divide again. And they think that because their DNA is now defective from smoking or whatever damage. And that will mean that the cell does go through the cell cycle. It starts as one defective cell. That defective cell thinks it's supposed to divide, and it will. Now you have two cells that are both identically defective, because the damage of the DNA that occurred will then be copied before the cell, in DNA replication, before the cell splits into two. So that's why it gets out of control. Now these two cells both think they're supposed to go through the cell cycle immediately, and now you have four defective cells. That's how a tumor starts. Yeah. In a sense, there are genes called oncogenes. Onco means cancer, like oncology, the study of cancer. Oncogenes are genes that are normal, but that if they mutate in a certain way, will turn into cancer-causing genes. And for cancers that so-called run in the family, which means offspring have a higher chance than the normal public of developing cancer, which is different from actually getting cancer from a parent, right? You still don't have cancer if you have a high probability because of family. You have to still develop it on your own. But anyway, what that means is that both parents might have given the child one of these versions that are likely to mutate, and therefore the child and the siblings will have a higher chance than the overall public of actually having cancer happen because of mutation. You still have to have mutation occur, though. Does that answer the question? Okay. Well, let's go on to 18, which is also about cancer. This is how a tumor forms, though. A single cell through some sort of mutation. And mutation, which we'll talk more about later, is any change in DNA sequence. Can happen all kinds of different ways. For instance, simply by a random error occurring when copying is done. Doesn't have to be damage because of the environment, but sometimes it is. Sunlight can cause mutation. Skin cancers caused by ultraviolet radiation, for instance. Smoking, like I mentioned, all kinds of things. Just living causes mutations because they randomly occur. And this, by the way, is why cancer is so much more likely the older you get. Your DNA is getting copied many more times the older you're getting, providing more chance for mistakes to occur. Okay, but anyway, starts as one cell, but that since they don't have the ability to turn off their cell cycle, they've lost that control, they'll just keep dividing, forming a tumor wherever. In this case, breast cancer, but could happen anywhere in the body. Now, a tumor by itself isn't necessarily going to do anything bad. It's just a mass of cells in a given area. But the bigger it gets, the more likely it is to directly affect the function of whatever organ it's in, simply because of its size and pushing on other things around it and so on. And also could be releasing chemicals. But this is why early detection is so important. If the tumor continues to grow, of course it's going to be made out of more and more cells. And the more cells are in the tumor, the more likely it will become for one of those cells in the tumor to just randomly detach from the tumor, get carried in lymph or blood that goes through the body, and take up residence in some other organ. It's still a cancerous cell. It still thinks it's supposed to divide, so it'll start a brand new tumor there. And that's what metastasis is. Metastasis is the spread of cancer causing tumors in other organ systems. And metastatic cancer is much more difficult to treat because it's no longer localized. And that's when it's much worse news than if it is just a localized cancer. As a matter of fact, cancer is occurring in most people without them ever even knowing it, because we actually have ways of detecting our own cancer cells and killing them before they would even be detectable by a test. When it's detectable by a test, that means it's cells that have eluded our own self-checkers and grew into a tumor. That is the chapter, though. So let me switch recordings.